Wow, got muted there right off the get-go. Welcome back to the Compass live stream. This is the best and the only live stream dedicated to proof of work mining. We're glad you're watching. As we all know, a ton of hash rate has been leaving China, left China, and most of it has ended up in North America. But typically, the majority of the conversation around this global shift in hash power has focused on the United States half of North America. And by the United States, I mean Texas and Wyoming, pretty much. In reality, though, this conversation sort of describes only half of this seismic shift in the mining market. And today, we have two great guests to talk all about the other half, a little bit further north, of the massive growth in North America's mining market in Canada. We have Ben Gannon, Chief Mining Officer from Bitfarms, and Jamie Liberton, CEO of Hut 8. Ben and Jamie, it's honestly going to be a ton of fun having you guys on the show. I'm super excited you're both here. Thanks for coming on the live stream.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to be here.
So we have a couple questions I want to get to. I don't really like to plan these conversations too much. I think they're more fun the less planning they have. But I want to start off with a super broad, open-ended question. First to you, Ben, and then Jamie, I want to hear your thoughts as well. Like, what's going on in Canada? What's been happening? I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot of headlines about Texas and Wyoming. Everyone loves to talk about those states. I don't want to talk about any of that. I want to talk about Canada. What's been going on with Bitcoin or other proof of work mining in Canada right now, Ben?
Yeah, I think everybody is, you know, looking to North America, and that's, I don't think there's really a division here between the United States and Canada in terms of Chinese looking to relocate their miners. They're looking to North America because both countries are great jurisdictions. And, you know, after China, this is the second and third largest producers of electricity in the world. So when you've got gigawatts of power that, you know, just came offline in China that all need to find a new home, you're going to go to the two primary, you know, producers of electricity that are next on the list. So we're seeing huge inquiries, at least into our company, that are asking for capacity that's honestly multiples of what we have listed on our website for installed infrastructure. And they're coming in every day. There's no shortage of demand here. And in terms of, you know, our operations in the province and our operations in Canada, you know, we're aggressively expanding in Quebec. We're working to fill out our entire 160 megawatts worth of hydropower that we've got contracted here, which is a little bit more than half that was granted in the initial 300 megawatts back in 2018. So we're aggressively working to develop all of that. I know a couple of other companies are also working to, you know, tap into the better market opportunities right now. But things are just take longer in the US and Canada than they would in China. And so that's something that I think the Chinese need to understand is there's no building a facility here in 8 weeks. It just does not happen. You know, it's going to take you multiples of that. We're talking timeframes measured in months and probably on the outside of 8 to 10 months now to go from a completely new project where you're negotiating, you're securing the power, you're getting the permits, you're ordering all the materials, you're actually building everything and deploying everything. You know, it's significantly longer than what they're expecting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There's, I mean, I think we all have at least heard of, probably had plenty of our own conversations with Chinese miners looking to very aggressively and quickly relocate their ASICs. Some just throwing them in storage and sort of waiting, but most people trying to find relocation. I was just talking with Amanda from Galaxy, and she said this week has been, like the past several months, but this week especially has been insane for them. Jamie, we were just talking before the stream started. You had the exact same week. Can you like tell us what's going on up there with you amidst all of this shuffling of hash rate and people looking to sort of set up business in Canada?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think we're probably all getting the same calls. So we're all having conversations probably about similar opportunities. So we're all talking about the same magnitude. And it's been going on for a number of weeks now. But yes, it is escalating. We haven't seen a lot of actual like contracts being signed or cash start to be transferred. It's still very much in the phase of conversations and negotiations. I think there is a lot of interest in the province of Alberta, which is where we are. It's obviously one of the most energy rich areas of Canada. There's a lot of interest going on in behind the fence power generation and what can be done around natural gas in the province of Alberta. So those conversations are definitely active. But as I say, we still seem to be very much in the exploratory phase for most of this demand moving from China. And it'll be interesting to see how that evolves and when things actually start to get locked down and contracted. And I completely agree with Ben on the timeline challenges here. We're building out a new site in Alberta, and luckily we were able to get our transformer order in a while back and secure aggressive lead times. But I'm now hearing transformer orders alone are looking at 50 to 55 week lead times. Like, we all know about the global supply chain constraints, and now there's just a ton of people looking to build out more power, and the components required are constrained. So I don't think that comes as a surprise to anybody, but it certainly is going to delay this hash rate coming back on at scale in new locations.
Yeah, for sure. That makes a lot of sense. A lot of miners sort of want to cram their machines in an already sort of a market that's saturated with demand and sort of has a strong dearth of supply. We've known this, but everything has just gotten, 5-10x worse over the past 3 or 4 months. That's interesting. Well, I'm excited to dive in a little bit, given that sort of context. I kind of want to start off with what I like to call shilling your bags. And by that, I mean, I just want to talk a little bit more about Hut 8 and Bitfarms growth. We had a couple weeks ago, we had Jason from Riot and Fred from Marathon on the show, and they gave us a pretty good overview, of the sort of southern half of the North American mining market here in the US and its growth and whatnot. But I want to hear more specifics about Bitfarms and Hut 8. Jamie, back to you. Can you, over the past 12 months, maybe, where has Hut 8 come from to where it is now? What have you guys been working on in terms of facility build out, hash rate growth, that sort of stuff? What does Hut 8 look like today?
Happy to. I've only been here now for 8 months, so maybe we'll start at the 8 month mark when I showed up, which was.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks, Zach. Yeah, it's certainly been a busy, exciting time to kind of join a company in this industry. And obviously, we've had tremendous, tremendous growth and in lots of different areas of the business. So since I took over, we've dramatically expanded our leadership team. We've dramatically increased the hash rate. We've expanded our hosting line of business. We've made a strategic announcement with NVIDIA, and then using Dell chassis to support the NVIDIA card. So later this month, we'll be standing up the first phase of what will be 1600 gigahash worth of mining in using the NVIDIA CMPs. And initially, we will mine Ethereum, but continue to settle in Bitcoin. From an exahash perspective, we announced yesterday that we're currently sitting at 1.374 exahash, which is more than double where we were this time last year. And we've got another exahash on order, expecting to deliver in the fourth quarter of this year. So certainly lots of activity underway. And then we're super proud to have the largest stack of self-mined Bitcoin of any publicly traded company in the world. And we have, I'm trying to think of the latest math. We've added about 2,000 Bitcoin to our balance sheet alone in the last 8 months. So really, really proud of our position there. And this year also, we started to use that Bitcoin to earn yield with a portion of it. So we've now diversified our revenue streams away. So we're self-mining. Bitcoin is obviously our dominant line of business and will continue to be our focus. But we also now earn fiat revenue from the hosting side of our business, the yield side of our business, and then we have the option with mining the Ethereum network and using GPU mining to kind of hedge against the mining dynamics associated with mining Bitcoin alone. So,
sure, yeah,
I think
we're looking at some of your. That's awesome. I think we're looking at some of your.
That's
can you tell us what we're watching here?
Yeah, you're watching an aerial view of our facility in Medicine Hat, Alberta. As you can see, we use container-based systems, each one representing about 1.2 megawatts of power. We take advantage, as you can see, of the naturally cool, windy, dry climate in Alberta to use free air cooling for our data centers, which is fantastic. And look, we've been really, really vocal about loving Alberta and the not just the climate there, but the geopolitical environment. We get incredible support from the city of Medicine Hat, which is where our largest facility is built. And the city of Medicine Hat is an independent power authority, so definitely some advantages by working with them in that site. So that's what you saw. That's what we've been up to. Of course, probably the most important strategic move that we've made in the last 7 months, besides growth, is the dual listing on the NASDAQ. So incredibly proud to be the first Canadian miner to list on the NASDAQ, and we worked really hard to get on the top tier of that exchange. So yeah, very exciting, but lots
that's
of great
awesome.
Stuff. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I know Will has a few questions for different things you mentioned, specifically about the different provinces and jurisdictions that you operate in. Before we dig into that a little bit, though, Ben, I want to toss it over to you. Can you give us a similar rundown on Bitfarms? I know you guys, even outside of Canada, Latin America, other places, you guys are also expanding like crazy. Every mining company is, you guys on the NASDAQ too now. Can you give us like from now to over like the past 12 months, where has Bitfarm sort of grown from to where you guys are now?
Sure. We've grown tremendously over the last 12 months. I'm not sure exactly August 13th to date last year, but we were somewhere around 765 or 800 petahash back then. We're 1.4 three, I believe, as of today. So we're about double what we were about 12 months ago. We've installed a little over 12,000 new WhatsMiner machines in that time period. We've got a bunch more WhatsMiner machines on the way. We negotiated a purchase for 48,000 WhatsMiner machines for delivery next year, and the 7,300 S19 J Pros that will be coming between now and the end of October. So we've got our first delivery of those coming up in about 2 weeks' time. So we're looking forward to adding, 220 petahash a month onto that hash rate and continuing our growth further. We've did a number of different things. Yeah, like Hut 8, we also got uplisted onto the NASDAQ. So now we're dual listed on TSX and on NASDAQ. That was a huge, huge accomplishment for us. And it shows, we've been doing a number of good things to attract professional investors into this space. The two companies here have been at it longer than pretty much anyone else. And it's a good thing that we're starting to finally make moves into the right markets and attract the right kind of investors into the space and give them the exposure to Bitcoin that, they so desperately need and want. And so we've added, I think it's 96% of our Bitcoin that we've mined this year, we've added into long-term treasuries. So a huge amount of Bitcoin that we're putting on our balance sheet. That's been a big benefit to shareholders and will continue to be a big benefit to shareholders over the long term as we continue to stack that and accumulate all of that Bitcoin for longer and longer time periods. The China exodus has been really beneficial for us. We've been able to do things like negotiate lower prices on our existing purchase contracts with both Bitmain and MicroBT, which has been fantastic. That drastically lowers our capital needs growing forward in order to achieve our target growth. And then we are doing international expansion. So, with the China ban, the big thing is infrastructure, and that's our bread and butter. We are not a company that just buys equipment and hosts it with a third party. We build and operate all of our own facilities. And that's something that we've done for the last 4 years. We have our vertically integrated electrical engineering company that helps us do that. And we're expanding aggressively, not just in Quebec, but we're building our first site in South America. We're actively exploring a couple of different opportunities in the United States, and we're looking for further opportunities in the province of Quebec beyond what we've already contractually secured. So we're going to take advantage of, this new dynamic. The bottleneck is now infrastructure, not miners. Like you said, I think a huge amount of those miners are just going into storage. And the price of the hardware has kind of been interesting over the last couple of weeks. You know, even with the huge amount of supply, the price is still tracking according to the present value of the cash flow. And so, you know, it's the value of this equipment is still going up. We haven't actually seen a permanent reduction in those prices. So I'm glad that we were able to take advantage of the better economics at the time and lock in lower prices with our two main suppliers.
That's yes. Awesome. Hang on. I want Damien to throw up a clip here. We captured some footage from Bitfarms too. Ben, can you tell us what we're looking at here really quick?
Yeah, this is Magog. We've got 5 data centers in the province of Quebec, ranging from 10 to 30 megawatts. This one is 10 megawatts here. It's a really simple hot aisle system in the middle with 2 racks of miners on either side. This particular facility is completely full up with M31S Plus. So cool. We should have a few thousand, I'm not sure what that would be, about 3,000 or so M31S Plus in that facility.
This shot right here looks like you could shoot a pretty cool action movie in those aisles. That's
yeah. Cool. If you turn off all the lights and you just have the green glow of the miners, it does provide some pretty cool Independence Day shots.
That's awesome.
Lasers, Zach. Got to get some lasers for our own videos.
For sure. Will, I know you had a question there to hop in. What's up?
Yeah, no, tons of questions here. So I think, Ben, that was an interesting point on the last segment there, your last thought there about ASIC prices kind of tracking Bitcoin prices, even though we're seeing kind of a glut of supply. We had a Twitter space yesterday, and Vincent, who runs procurement for us, was talking about how they're still seeing a lot of Chinese miners holding on to the latest generation of miners. And there's been some liquidations in the older generations, but for the most part, miners are just kind of holding steady. And so you're seeing that somewhat in how ASIC prices are moving. But just wanted to note that, because my question is actually something totally different. I want to talk about regulation in the space. So both you guys operate in different provinces for the most part, from my understanding, Alberta versus Quebec. And mm-hmm. Ben, you noted in a CoinDesk op-ed, or not an op-ed, rather just an article last month, that there's been a lot of challenges operating in Quebec on the regulatory front. And that kind of pushed you guys to move to other locations, including that new plant you guys have in Argentina. And then that's contrasted against the information you just talked about, Jamie, with Medicine Hat being very open for you guys being in the space. So Ben, I want to start with you, and maybe Jamie, we can move over. Like, on the provincial level, is that kind of the bottleneck, or is it like on the federal level for Canada? Like, what's the regulatory landscape like in Canada for Bitcoin mining?
Well, I mean, first of all, that CoinDesk article is kind of a hit piece on us. I mean, we went in there and we talked about how we're doubling our infrastructure in the province of Quebec, and the headline said we're leaving the province of Quebec. So there's some pretty bad reporting there in that article, but the regulatory burdens with the province of Quebec are historical, and those date back to the last bear run we had back in 2017 and 2018, when we had Chinese trying to come over to North America the last time around. And they were looking to, you know, get into a better jurisdiction and protect their equipment during the last bull run up to 20K. And the province of Quebec, I believe, had 18 gigawatts worth of demand applications in from Chinese Bitcoin miners. And a lot of those were probably redundant. And so Hydro-Quebec is where all of this comes from. We have effectively a state-owned entity, Hydro-Quebec, that provides all the power, and it's kind of got a quasi monopoly on the electricity grid in Quebec. But, you know, they are scared of 18 gigawatts worth of power applications. And so they capped it at 300 megawatts. And we spent a lot of time back in 2018 lobbying and explaining to different politicians and Hydro-Quebec officials about, you know, what is our business, what we're actually doing, how we actually provide a grid stability service, you know, through curtailment programs and demand response programs. And, you know, we were able to secure more than 50% of the power allotted for crypto mining applications. But there are further opportunities in the province of Quebec through more municipality utilities. So there's the provincial utility, and then there's municipality utilities. And the municipality utilities tend to have a bit more flexibility. And there is huge amounts of infrastructure in the province of Quebec that, you know, initially built and funded all these hydroelectric dams. We've got gigawatts and gigawatts worth of excess power production that are actually being transmitted, you know, thousands of kilometers down on pipelines down to New York and being sold for half the price. So you're losing a bunch of it in transmission. You're selling it for a fraction of the price that you would, and all the revenue for the province or all the revenue for Hydro-Québec goes to the province as an alternative to tax. And because it goes back into social programs, schools, roads, that sort of thing. The areas where, you know, we see the most opportunity and where we're actively pursuing is areas where former industry left. And so these are more remote hydroelectric dams. These are smaller municipalities that are eager for jobs, eager for tax revenue, and they want to work, you know, they want to bring this kind of investment there. And so I think that's where the opportunities are going to lie. You know, our five data centers are in the Eastern Townships area, all within about a max of an hour and 15 minute drive from Montreal. You can imagine that, you know, there's limited opportunities there to scale up with huge 100 megawatt data centers being so close to a major population center and with huge amounts of power demand already. So we're looking to go further out in the province where, you know, the regulatory burden is significantly less. And we have, you know, great opportunities to come in there and make a substantial impact at the municipal level in terms of GDP, job creation, tax revenue for that county.
Interesting. Yeah. Same question to you, Jamie, just wondering about the regulatory landscape as you move from like province to province within Canada and like the bottlenecks you guys are facing that may be different from Bitfarms, which is operating in Quebec.
Yeah, Alberta is a different environment. It's a province that was traditionally very oil and gas heavy. They were really looking forward to the progress of the Keystone Pipeline, which unfortunately was canceled when Biden took over office. So it's a province that's incredibly energy rich, very supportive of innovation. It's a conservative government there, and so we haven't faced the same challenges. If anything, it's an environment that's welcoming of new industry and innovation that can take advantage of those energy assets that otherwise aren't being put to work effectively today.
That's interesting. I want to hop around a little bit. I know Will didn't have a question about ASIC prices, but we had one from the chat that sort of mentioned it. Let me share the screen really quick because you mentioned, and Witt isn't on the call to defend himself, but I think his prediction is pretty reasonable. Damien, if you can throw up the screen there. Witt said we'll see ASICs priced at or maybe above 25K next year as we see, you know, basically demand for these machines with some of the supply just thrown into storage and more people wanting to mine as profitability increases. I think hash price is around 40 cents last I checked, maybe 39 now. The question from chat basically was, do you guys agree with this prediction? Maybe back to you, Jamie, first, and then Ben. And if not, like, what would you say, like a year from now, maybe, what would you think, you know, the latest gen highest efficiency ASIC is that would be running for on the market?
I personally don't see that. I think there's a lot of supply out there. I think that potentially it's being manipulated and held back to keep prices high at the present time. I feel like we're going to be surprised with new entrants into the market. I think there's a lot of R&D happening from new companies. I think more and more there's a recognition that digital asset mining is here to stay. And the companies that have kind of thought it was a fad, thought it would go away, are slowly waking up to this is a big opportunity that's really still in the early stages. And I think that once we get more competition in, it will moderate the current conditions we're under with being tied to only two vendors really at the top tier.
Sure. Ben, I don't know. What do you think? Is 25K too bullish of a price for ASICs?
I mean, it's a distinct possibility, I think. There are two things that are going to determine the price. And one is going to be what happens with Bitcoin price and how does that trickle down into the USD per terahash price. The second thing is going to be how quickly can people build out new infrastructure. And the faster that Bitcoin rips, the bigger the opportunity cost there's going to be for not having that infrastructure deployed, which means that people are going to look to deploy at higher and higher prices, right? So the 6 cents, you know, that has been a historical norm as a break-even barrier or like a barrier that nobody really wants to go above, I think is going to go out the window. And we're going to enter into an environment where Bitcoin's ripping at 80K, 100K, people are going to start paying whatever prices they can. And if you look at how the hosting contracts have been split up, you know, in the United States, this is a form factor that, or a business model that the Chinese are not used to at all. When you host in China, it's a flat fee for your power and a flat fee for your hosting, and there's no sort of profit split included. For pretty much every new hosting contract that's being signed in the United States right now, a profit split is a big component, if not the primary method of compensation for the hosting company. And when you back that into a per kilowatt hour cost, especially on these new S19Js and in a very high profitability environment, the cost per kilowatt becomes very expensive. You know, you could easily see a cost per kilowatt hour with the profit split included at 10, 12, 14 cents. And, you know, if price keeps ripping and profitability keeps going up, that price per kilowatt hour will increasingly go up as well. Now, you have that downside protection, but it's gonna incentivize people to make investments that they would have never, ever considered before in order to get this equipment deployed. And when you look at what the Chinese are doing, I mean, this is a call option on Bitcoin. You know, you can hold this equipment and hope that the Bitcoin goes up, and it's a call option on Bitcoin. And so, you know, I don't think anybody who has made significant commitments to buy, you know, Bitcoin mining machines on a 12-month contract is bearish on Bitcoin. They're bullish, and they're waiting for that long-term price appreciation. And they're saying, well, you know what, we can, some of these people have got very good price contracts, and we can put these in storage, and we can wait for price to rip, and we can sell them at a better price than we can sell them at today. And so this is a very possible number that we can see. It just really depends on how bullish you are on Bitcoin price and what kind of a time frame. And know that the Bitcoin price going higher is going to drive higher and higher cost Bitcoin mining developments. You know, it's the sure. Miami situation where the mayor was trying to get people down there and do nuclear power at 10 cents, you know, made no sense. But now it might be attractive. And if Bitcoin hits 100K, you know, and we start seeing stuff like a dollar per terahash, you can bet people are going to pay 10 cents for nuclear power over a 25% profit split. And sure. These are things that are hard to predict because we've never seen anything like this before. So this is completely new space, completely new economics. I don't think WIP's out of place. I mean, those miners could, I think he could easily hit those prices if we're hitting 100K Bitcoin by the end of the year.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's not talked about often enough that we have a lot of conversations in the crypto industry about all the leverage. I don't think it's talked about often enough that miners are some of the most heavily leveraged long players in this industry out of everyone. And hoarding ASICs or just mining with ASICs, building new farms is a massively leveraged long play on Bitcoin. Miners have to be the most bullish in many senses of anyone in the industry. I think it's interesting, though, at a couple different points you guys have mentioned, like mining outside of North America, outside of the US and Canada. And my question to both of you, especially Ben, with you guys opening up in Argentina, but for Jamie and Ben, both of you, is the US and Canada sort of, as we're inside of the first year of this post-China, not post-China, but post-China crackdown era, are the US and Canada kind of like just the first stops in this progress, and people will sort of, you know, have their fill of North American mining opportunities and then sort of expand elsewhere to other countries as all of this infrastructure continues to be built out? Like where will the US and Canada be in terms of prioritization for miners looking for new rack space, I guess, over the next 2 to 3 years between now and the halving? And will we see sort of heavy dilution in the market in terms of geographic distribution, whereas now, like, you know, it's kind of China or North America, and like Kazakhstan and parts of Africa and Latin America in there too. But will we see everything sort of smoothed out and balanced much more evenly, or are we going to see just sort of like a persistent shift from, well, it's not in China, so it's all going to be pretty much in North America now? Back to you, Ben, and then Jamie, like, what do you both think?
I think the Chinese will go wherever the power is available and is cost effective. You know, they're not like Americans. Their way to view jurisdictions and jurisdictional risk is completely different. And they actually, I think, in a lot of cases would prefer going to a place that's a lot more unregulated and flexible, and you can have drinks with the guy and shake hands and you know, effectively have a deal, as opposed to going through the regulatory burden that you have in the United States or Canada to, you know, file for applications, get permits, do all the waiting. You know, this is something that they're not used to. But if you look at the power demand, if you run back the amount of hash rate that we've lost from the peak on, I think it was April 15th or so, to where we dropped down to around 90 exahash, and you reverse back with a 60 watt per terahash or an 80 watt per terahash efficiency, we're looking at somewhere around 2.2 million machines and 6.5 gigawatts at the 60 watt per terahash, and about 4.4 million machines and 8.4, I think, gigawatts worth of power at the 80 watts per terahash range. I mean, this is huge amounts of infrastructure, not just on the power side, but on the rack space. And then that doesn't include the, you know, roughly 100,000 new miners that are being produced every single month. So, you know, they're going to go wherever they can deploy that equipment, I think. But when you look at the power curve, you know, the countries that produce power are exponential. And so China's by far the number one electricity producer and consumer. United States does about 60% of that. Canada does about 60% of the United States. And the curve just continues down like that. So if you're looking for available infrastructure, US and Canada by far outpace the rest of the world. And you're going to go to those places first. And obviously, there's going to be some opportunities in other countries. But if just looking at the pure power numbers, US and Canada lead the world by far if you're not including China. And so I think that's why the focus is here. And I think the focus will continue to be here, because the last thing that you want, I think, when Bitcoin price is ripping and your machines are producing huge cash flows, is a regulatory crackdown and a concern that you're going to have missed opportunity costs because some government officials came in and said, you can't do this anymore, or you can't do this until you, you know, pay this or pay that. So I think the stability of the regulatory regime is really, really important. And that's where US and Canada really have an edge, and places like Norway and Sweden, you know, have an edge as well. But it's the pure power numbers, which is what's drawing people here.
Sure. Yeah. Same question to you, Jamie. And like really quick, I guess, you know, the US and Canada obviously have a much more stable regulatory environment, but even still, they are very different, but maybe not any less strong potential regulatory concerns, I guess, surrounding things like types of power use and environmental concerns and that sort of stuff. So I guess less regulated and more regulated environments both carry their own different batches of concerns. Jamie, same question to you. Like, US and Canada sort of like first stop, everyone comes here first and then dissipates everywhere else, or will the US and Canada now sort of always be the hub for hash power going forward?
I wouldn't predict always in association with anything in this industry, but I do think the availability of power is kind of the number one area of concern that's going to keep them coming back. But the more dominant this industry becomes, I think the more we'll see innovation, the more we'll see other jurisdictions playing in it. And I think diversification is going to be important as companies continue to grow at scale, because any geopolitical environment can turn at any time or another, depending on what happens. So the more diversified these large scale operations are, the more they're diversifying their risk profile. And I think over time that will become an important consideration as well.
Awesome. So we got some interesting questions in the chat we're going to pivot to really quick. So Gary Jenkins asks, what is the chance that China leaders reverse course and allow some preferred miners to come back online in China? So this is, you know, speculation hour right now. So Jamie, we'll throw it back to you, and then Ben will get some thoughts.
I think it's not out of the realm of possibility at all. We have seen flip-flopping in the past, and I think there may be some miners that are kind of taking a wait and see approach and kind of hedging their bet that this could swing back in their favor. That's my view.
You know, the preferred mining section is the interesting part of that question. You know, like generally speaking, I'd say there's no chance that mining becomes legal again in China. this was not about an ESG crackdown at all. This is about currency controls and capital controls. This is something I know pretty well. I was born and raised in Hong Kong. I operated mining facilities in mainland China starting in 2015. I speak Chinese. I mean, this is a market I understand. And when they do these crackdowns every year, it's never been serious. It's been making an example out of one person, you know, confiscating the equipment and redistributing it amongst their friends, which is what makes that kind of an interesting preferred comment. I don't think you can ever rule out anything that's centered around government corruption. I think that's something we as Bitcoiners know is a big part of why Bitcoin exists and why we're all here and why we're all involved in it. But that being said, it's about the capital controls, and I don't think it will be worth it to them as a government to allow some people and ruin that reputational image and ruin that reputational control by allowing small groups of people to do that. So I think it's pretty unlikely that will go through. We saw a historical precedent back in 2017, I believe it was, with Ethereum and Bitcoin and Litecoin. So China made a big crackdown with regards to the exchanges back in 2017. I believe this is January 2017, if my memory is correct. And what they did was they forced the exchanges to stop doing BTC withdrawals. And before, you could send your RMB to the exchange, you could withdraw your Bitcoin to a global exchange, you can sell it for yen, US dollars, whatever that was, and you got around the $50,000 a year capital control. What the government did is said, okay, well, no more Bitcoin exchanges, no more Bitcoin withdrawals. You could still send your RMB there, you could buy Bitcoin, you could sell your Bitcoin there, and you could withdraw your RMB, but you couldn't send your Bitcoin abroad. Well, they implemented that for Bitcoin and Litecoin, but they didn't implement it for Ethereum or anything else. And so the Chinese just instantly moved over to Ethereum. And you can actually see the price of Ethereum. You go back and look at the regulations, you can see the price of Ethereum go from $7 to $20 to $430 directly following these capital control measures that China put into place, right? And so you see how quickly the Chinese adapt to new sorts of regulations and still work around it. I don't think they're going to provide any sort of leeway because they understand that Bitcoin mining is a very effective vehicle for that. You buy the machines in RMB, you pay your power prices in RMB, and you can export your Bitcoin anywhere in the world. So I don't think it's coming back.
Makes one wonder whose ear Vitalik had in that moment, but I won't speculate too much. So I'm glad you actually brought up Ethereum because I do want to talk about Hut 8's involvement with Ethereum mining, but I want to keep the conversation open to Ben as well, as I understand that you guys don't operate in that space too much. So just in terms of public markets, though, you're both publicly listed and therefore you're public listing stock price is very much so tied to the price of Bitcoin and everything else involved with the Bitcoin industry. Hut 8, though, has a little diversification because you are in the Ethereum market as well. And then slowly, I'm assuming you'll move into a GPU market where you can just do computational work itself. So I'm interested, just on the base level, Jamie, just starting with you, when you're looking at your stock price, how important has it been to add diversification to your product lineup in terms of the price and it's reflecting there? And then Ben, when we come back to you, I'd like to talk about how you guys kind of manage your stock price expectations in terms of Bitcoin price. I mean, obviously both of you guys' stocks are doing really well this year, and I won't make you guys answer too in depth so SEC is not rating us, but interested to get your thoughts.
I think it's really, really difficult to answer that question because what moves our stock price? There are so many different variables that impact sentiment and how stocks move in our industry. We don't yet see a direct correlation between our stock and Ethereum. So when Ethereum movements don't seem to have a direct correlation with us yet. That said, we made the announcement back in the spring, and the first phase of the NVIDIA cards and chassis arrived to site later this month. So I think we'll see if that changes when we get into full production, and we expect to have all 1600 gigahash up by the end of September. So that it may change, but right now I'm not seeing a direct correlation just given how we move versus the Ethereum price.
Ben, before we get to you, I want to ask a follow-up really quick. In terms of ETH2, obviously you probably get asked this question a ton, but very interested to know, you guys made a bet on ETH2 waiting a little bit, or at least be able to ROI on the machines that you're purchasing. So from a financial aspect, how did you guys kind of model out the predictions coming out of the Ethereum developer space on when ETH2 is going to launch and how you guys can capitalize on mining Ethereum before that date?
Yeah, so when we ran the business case, we obviously modeled a variety of different scenarios, including what if ETH 2.0 happens, you know, at the end of this year, what would we move the compute to? And just making sure that the model held, whether we were mining Ethereum or Ethereum Classic or whatever else the next most profitable network to mine would be. And the case does hold. So we're kind of agnostic as to how the timeline moves with respect to our business case.
Interesting. Okay. Ben, tossing over to you, when you're talking about you guys as a public company and managing expectations for that aspect of your business and Bitcoin's price, obviously they're very tightly correlated in the same way that ASIC prices are very correlated with Bitcoin's price. So just interested to get your perspective as a public firm on Bitcoin stocks and Bitcoin mining stocks.
Sure. You know, a lot of us, myself included, started out with Ethereum. I started mining Ethereum before I started mining Bitcoin. Our two co-founders also started out with mining Ethereum. And in the past, we have mined Ethereum, Ethereum Classic, Litecoin, Dash. Bitcoin Cash, I think we even have some of. I mean, we've done a lot of diversification in the past, but what we find is there's a couple of complications with that. One, we can't really predict the successfulness of any coin other than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a unique animal, and long term, we know exactly where that price is going. We don't know exactly when, but the trend is irreversible and incredibly clear. And I don't think that's true for any other coin. And that impacts a lot of other things. You know, when we're coming out and doing hardware purchases for altcoins, the pricing is very, very volatile, even more volatile than the Bitcoin mining machines. And especially if you're buying an altcoin ASIC, you know, the reason my manufacturers produce those is because they can hype incredibly high profitability now, sell a ton of machines at an incredibly high price and dump them on everybody. And that is not a market I want to be involved in. I don't think it's a market that's good for our shareholders, for us to be taking those kind of risks. What we can do with the Bitcoin mining equipment, which is heavily commoditized, is we can predict the prices of those hardware pretty well, and we can track those pretty well. And we know that we don't have any risk of, hey, we need to ROI on this in 3 or 4 months or we're screwed. You know, we know that our hardware is going to work for 5, 6, 7 years profitably as long as we maintain it well in a good operating environment. And that's what we do. I mean, we build and operate, you know, mining facilities, and we do it well. And so we know with our Bitcoin miners that we're going to be able to generate huge cash flows for many, many years, well beyond our ability or our need to finance, you know, those miners. And so it's a very predictable thing for us. And that's why we focus on that. We know that, you know, our pure play Bitcoin strategy is pretty important. You know, if you're bullish on Bitcoin, you should be even more bullish on Bitcoin mining. For companies like ours that don't have a profit split, you know, attached to our hosting contracts, as we don't, you know, do really any hosting, what that means is that our operating costs are fixed, right? I mean, it doesn't matter what Bitcoin price is. Our cost to operate a 30 megawatt facility or a 20 megawatt facility is fixed, and all that upside is ours. And so we protect our downside by building good facilities and negotiating good power contracts in the first place. But we want all of that upside. And any company that's signing hosting agreements with a 25% profit split does not maintain all of that upside and will look at increasingly higher and higher costs over time. So, you know, that's where we're structured, is be this pure play, you know, Bitcoin deal. And you can compare us to like a Galaxy Digital, you know, trust where they're holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet. The big difference with us and them is that, you know, they can only dollar cost average their Bitcoin up over time because they're purchasing Bitcoin at higher and higher prices. For us, we're adding new Bitcoin to our balance sheet every single day. We're doing it for significantly below market value. And as we negotiate, you know, better power purchases, as we deploy more efficient equipment, we can actually reduce our average cost per Bitcoin further still. So, you know, would you rather have a fixed basket of Bitcoin, or would you rather have a basket of Bitcoin that's growing every single day and is produced for significantly below market value? I think I think that's the real advantage here. And by simplifying our business model and focusing on it, we can execute it well, and we can deliver to our investors something that's clear and is focused on what we believe is going to be the best performing asset over the next 10 years, and that's Bitcoin. I don't think any other commodity or any other asset will outperform Bitcoin over the next decade. So, you know, we don't actually want to diversify. We want to be all in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to be clear, we're mining Ethereum, but settling in Bitcoin. So we're using it more as a side door to stack more Bitcoin, but have diversification of a different network for difficulty.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, I just want to say, I told Will before the show that there was a quota on how many Ethereum questions he could ask. And I think we've met that quota.
I have like three more. But we'll,
whatever. Maybe we get to one more later. But Will is our resident Ethereum fanboy. I kind of want to keep, or well, actually, I want to look at the chat really quick, because we have Bitsby Trippin, who's a big GPU miner, watching the stream. Thanks for watching. I wanted to keep the same train of thought with regard to Bitcoin and public mining companies, though, because, you know, historically we've seen a lot of people, a lot of investors sort of use mining stocks as an indirect way to get exposure directly to Bitcoin. But over the past, you know, 6 to 8 months, we've seen a huge growth in the attention paid to mining specifically. And Damien, if you can throw my screen up there really quick, we see like both of you guys' companies clearly outperforming Bitcoin over the past couple of years here. Are you, like, this is a little bit speculative, but I'm curious to know your thoughts on whether you think your investor base is still using, you know, Bitfarms and Hut 8 as a great tool for indirect exposure to Bitcoin, or whether they're actually, you know, understanding the nuances and difficulties of the mining industry, proof of work, Bitcoin mining industry, and they want, that's more now of what they want to buy into, and they're tracking, you know, hash price and hash rate growth and the geopolitical change ups and all of this sort of stuff. Jamie, first you, and then we'll pass it back to Ben. Like, what are your high level thoughts on people using companies as indirect exposure tools versus they understand mining and they want to buy into, you know, the mining industry?
I would definitely answer that it's a mix of both. I think historically, and certainly when Hut first was publicly listed in early 18, the value proposition was this is a proxy for Bitcoin that trades as a normal equity. So it's, you know, you don't have to worry about learning about hot wallets or cold wallets. You can just buy an equity, use your regular investment vehicles, but get that exposure to Bitcoin. But I think increasingly people are starting to understand mining as an independent class. They're starting to get more intelligent about how each of us is kind of different from one another, and they're getting much more interested in the entities themselves as opposed to just as a proxy. But it kind of depends on the stage an investor's at in kind of coming into this world, I think.
For sure. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Ben, same question to you. Like, more people using it as a proxy, or are people actually understanding and paying more attention to the mining sector itself?
I think it's mostly a proxy. I mean, we position ourselves, though, as a leverage play on Bitcoin. And, you know, Bitcoin goes up, we go up more, and Bitcoin goes down, we go down more. And as someone who's incredibly bullish on Bitcoin over the next 10 years, I'm really happy with that kind of strategy and positioning. I think it's important for people to understand, and I think they are starting to get around to this, is that when you look at Bitcoin and adding more Bitcoin to your balance sheet, there are actually very few things where if Bitcoin is your base treasury asset, very few things are going to predictably earn you a return in Bitcoin itself, right? They can predictably earn you a return in US dollars or yen or whatever that is. But earning a return and growing your Bitcoin to more Bitcoin is incredibly difficult with anything other than mining. But with mining, it's incredibly easy and predictable because we know every single day we're producing this many Bitcoin for this price, right? This is our cost to produce, you know, throughout the difficulty period. Then it adjusts, and this is our cost to produce. We can predict that when we're taking an ROI on our machines, this is what it costs for us in terms of Bitcoin now. This is what we expect it to generate in Bitcoin over the next 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And then when you look at it that way, that's a way that our Bitcoin turns into more Bitcoin, right? And that's a very, very unique thing with Bitcoin mining. You can't earn that in any other traditional industry when you're trying to keep up with Bitcoin price increases. It's going to be a dog chasing its tail, and you're always going to lose. So I think people are starting to understand this. And this is why, you know, they're interested in investing in Bitcoin mining. And this is why it's so great for publicly traded Bitcoin mining companies to exist, because this is a game where you either need to operate at very small scale or very large scale, and nothing in between makes sense. And it's difficult for people to get the, you know, economic advantages of scaling up and taking on all the educational, you know, efforts that you need to do to come up to speed to run a facility like this. You know, just like any other company, becoming public and providing investors with exposure to that and exposure to our experience, exposure to our economies of scale is a fantastic thing, not only for us as a form of raising capital, but for them as a form of, you know, making a return on their investment and preserving their purchasing power.
Yeah, jump in
yeah,
there.
For sure. Back to Jamie.
Can I ask, I know I'm not the question asker, but I am curious. Ben, you guys didn't used to HODL. You started HODLing this year. What changed that dynamic?
Our auditor. So we previously weren't allowed to HODL.
Interesting.
And we changed our auditor, so we're allowed.
Huh. Hmm.
Well, so we use a Big Four auditor, Jamie, and I believe we're still the only publicly traded mining company that uses a Big Four auditor. We thought, you know, 4 years ago, as institutional investors were going to come to the space, this was going to be a key thing that they were going to want to have to make sure that, hey, not only is this a good profitable business that gives us exposure to Bitcoin, but hey, they're done with a good reputable auditor, and we can actually trust their numbers and their books. Right. And so that was something that we did early on, and we thought that was important. We've wanted to HODL for a long time, but it wasn't something that we could get approved by the auditor. And so we made the strategic decision last year to switch auditors and get that process going. And unfortunately, we were able to do that basically right at the start of the bull run. Okay. and take advantage of that.
I always wondered that. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, guys, for letting me ask.
Bring all the info together. Kind of staying on like the same topic here, I'm wondering about financial derivatives for public miners. What are some things that you guys currently use, or maybe even use when you were private? And what are some products that you'd like to see going forward? I think in this conversation, we've noted that Hut 8 is holding a lot of its Bitcoin and then lending it as well to earn interest. I'm assuming that's how you earn interest. And then, Ben, you guys also HODL Bitcoin. And I don't know if you guys actively use that and lend it out on networks, or if you just hold it yourselves. But maybe, Jamie, we could start with you, like financial derivatives for miners.
Yeah, so we started this year back in January. We put 1,000 Bitcoin into a yield account with Genesis. And really, it was just in one way, it was a risk diversification strategy, because prior the whole stack was with a single custodian. So and obviously we have a longstanding relationship with Genesis, and we very much trust them. And as far as counterparty risk goes, so we put 1,000 Bitcoin into that account as a way to generate obviously fiat based revenue stream, so that we were putting our Bitcoin to work while keeping it on balance sheet and taking advantage of that belief that it will continue to appreciate up and to the right over time, short-term volatility aside, of course. We got a great reaction. Investors really love that we're actually putting that asset to work, and they wanted more from us. So we ended up entering into another one with another strategic counterparty of ours, Galaxy. So we now have 1,000 Bitcoin in the account with Galaxy, 1,000 with Genesis, and then the balance with the custodian. So it does diversify risk. It also allows us to add that differentiated revenue line that allows us to get a fiat-based income to help subsidize some of the fiat-based operating expenses, and ultimately keep more Bitcoin on balance sheet, of course, being a primary goal of HODLers.
Interesting. Okay. That makes a little bit more sense now. Thanks for that explanation. Ben, tossing it down to you, what are some financial derivatives that you guys use, or maybe you could just like explain to listeners that's pretty common for public mining firms to utilize?
We're not using any derivatives right now. We're just HODLing and putting all of our Bitcoin in custody. We're exploring different options in terms of how we can use our Bitcoin to gain more yield. But at the end of the day, we're a little bit, you know, cautious on who we're lending our Bitcoin with and what's actually happening with our Bitcoins. Like, as we said, you know, our Bitcoin is our most precious asset, and we think it's going to be the best performing commodity and asset over the next 10 years. And so it's important to grow that, but it's also important to protect it. And, you know, we haven't found a structure yet where we're comfortable with taking our most precious asset and putting it in somebody else's control. I don't think that's going to be the case forever. I think it's just where the market is right now. And I think as more players enter the space and more sophisticated products get introduced, it's definitely something that we're going to be looking to do. It's just not something that, you know, we found a structure that we're comfortable with yet.
Sure. That makes sense. I'm excited to see not only, you know, traditional derivative products that can help mining companies expand their revenue streams built out, but also, you know, crypto native sort of mining products, anything from like hash rate tokens to other forms of hash rate derivatives and hash price derivatives. It should be an exciting couple of years ahead for that sector. And in general, I want to thank you both for the time on the stream. It's been a ton of fun for me chatting with you both. I have an enormous amount of respect for both of you and your companies. I have two closing questions though for both of you. The first one, so I was chatting with Steve from Upstream, who also mines in Canada the other day. And this is kind of a black swan question. Damien, if you can throw up my screen there really quick. But this article was floating around, and this guy took a particular take that we must ban, I assume he's Canadian, mining in Canada. The question for both of you is, do you see this as even like, I mean, obviously a black swan you don't really expect, but is like, would this be kind of like a gray swan scenario that you think is within, you know, a reasonable realm of possibilities, where we'd see something like China happen in, maybe not even just in Canada, but like in other more regulated, highly developed countries where the tide just completely turns against mining. And, you know, the industry gets quite shaken up quite a bit. Like, yes or no, do you and why, I guess, is this not a possibility or a possibility? Jamie, back to you. And then Ben, would love to hear your thoughts too.
I think it's highly unlikely. I think we have seen a broad recognition that that Bitcoin in particular is here to stay. I think we don't have to debate, is Bitcoin a fad anymore? Is Bitcoin a currency for money laundering? Like those conversations we're just not having or seeing. Canada prides itself on innovation. It's always been looking for and focused on the energy sector and how to protect and advance the energy sector. And Bitcoin mining is an incredible opportunity to advance both of those goals. And again, Canada's energy rich. It's innovation focused. I think we're in an incredibly good position and an incredibly good jurisdiction.
Cool. That's reassuring. I mean, I didn't necessarily give it a high probability of actually happening, but just definitely wanted to ask. Ben, what do you think? Is it in within the remote realm of possibilities, or pretty safe to say it's not?
You know, this is a tough question because it's not about any numbers, right? I think we all know that this is an emotional game, and it's based on fear. It's not based on any of real data. Which is a really scary market to operate in. You know, we have regulators all over the world who are trying to regulate things that they have zero understanding about. And I think that's always a risk that we're facing. The beauty about being in the United States is that they move slowly. And the whole system in the United States was designed around creating a system where the federal government, you know, is going to be very, very difficult to overreach. And so any sorts of impact that we're going to see in the United States should be very slow, which is great. In Canada, you know, they can be a little bit more fast in terms of pushing forward legislation. And they have pushed forward, you know, a federal carbon tax, which they've been working on for several years and went into effect this year. And it is a threat, you know, in the long term to have these sorts of policies. Bitcoin mining is by far the world's best, most cost-effective technology at reducing emissions and doing so profitably and doing so with private dollars instead of government dollars. So if this is about the data, there's no chance of this happening because the benefits are clear. You know, we're revitalizing old infrastructure. We're actually reducing emissions in most cases. And we're doing so in a very, very cost-effective way, creating jobs, tax revenue, and everything else. But when everything is based around emotions and anybody can do whatever they want. And so I think that's always a risk.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense too. Unfortunately, I mean, there's a couple miners who are outspoken on Twitter that talk about this a lot. Unfortunately, almost all the narratives are very sort of emotionally driven, and very few conversations are driven by data. We wish it was the inverse, and we would easily win all of these conversations if it was the inverse. But last question for you guys, and this one might be a little bit more difficult to answer, but do you, maybe not, I don't know. Do you expect Canada, I guess, or North America in general, the US and Canada, to ever represent like over 50% of the network's hash rate, as sort of we've seen at different points in Bitcoin's history from China-based mining companies? Would US and Canadian, or just exclusively US or Canadian companies ever sort of cross that threshold in the future? We sort of talked about, you know, the global spread of hash power after China's crackdown a little early in this conversation. Do you think we'll ever reach that point where, over half of it is here? Ben, back to you. And then Jamie also would love to know your thoughts.
We are a significant amount of the power, but to be honest, I don't think we'll ever see another single jurisdiction hit over 50% of the hash rate. And I think that's a very good thing. I think that's a benefit for everybody and protects everybody's Bitcoins and everybody's wallets and protects the network as a whole. That means that if one country cracks down, you know, we continue. And this is the whole point of Bitcoin's anti-fragility. We are a system that is designed to, like a whack-a-mole game, you can hit us as hard as you can, as many times as you can, as fast as you can, but we will keep popping up. And that's the whole point. So I don't think we'll ever see an over than 50% mark. I do think that US and Canada's market share will rise tremendously over the next 18 to 24 months, though. But I don't think we'll hit break 50.
Jamie, do you agree, disagree? What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. And even if North America got 50% as a whole, we're still two separate countries, Canada and the US, separate jurisdictions. I don't see either one of us ever hitting 50%. There's too... It's just such a gigantic number, and there's too many other jurisdictions actively playing, and no, I don't see it.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point. There's definitely like crossing the Rubicon, I guess, but in a good way, moment for Bitcoin hash rate where it's spreading everywhere, and it's probably not going to, you know, congregate again. Well, we're at the mark here for time. This, again, has been an amazing conversation. Everyone who's watching, Ben and Jamie are both on Twitter. They don't shitpost too much, but we'll push them in that direction eventually. They're great follows, though, and both managing awesome companies in our industry. Thanks for watching. We'll be back next week with more Compass live streams. Jamie, Ben, again, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.